First of all, I want to thank everyone who's been listening. I really appreciate your support. Thanks especially to those folks who've taken the time to rate the podcast and leave a review. It really means a lot to me, and it helps new listeners find the show. In this episode, we'll be talking about some pretty gross details of botfly parasitism and reading from a firsthand account of intentional infection with botfly larvae. If this is making you flinch already, you may want to skip this episode. For some of you, I know that now you're even more eager to hear it, so I will not delay your listening pleasure.
Well, I didn't let it in, but it drilled right through my skin. Then it traveled to my brain, which it caused to be inflamed. It finally nestled in my liver, gave me fever and a shiver. It was the worst guest ever.
Imagine that you've just returned from a birdwatching trip in Central America, where you spent the hours around dawn and dusk hiking through hilly terrain, blanketed by tropical rainforest. As you peered through your binoculars at trogons and hummingbirds and tanagers for hours on end, you inevitably got multiple mosquito bites. "That happens," you mused. Yes, you had applied DEET-based insect repellent, but of course you missed some spots. And those little suckers are tenacious about finding any exposed bit of skin. After a few days, instead of getting better, a few of your bites have become slightly more swollen and painful. They don't look infected, but there's definitely something going on. You take a peek using your highest magnification reading glasses, and you see two tiny, thin tubes emerging from the center hole in each of the three bites that are giving you the most trouble. As it turns out, you are providing food and housing for three botfly larvae. I'm Sam Messier, and this is Worst Guest Ever, a podcast dedicated to parasites and their hosts. I've been with my partner, Anne, since 1998, and she has one rule for me while socializing with friends and family. No talking about parasites while people are eating. This podcast is my excuse to break the rules. Each episode, I'll discuss a parasitic organism with one or more special guests who will be feasting on a meal that I've designed to represent the featured parasite in some way. In this episode, we'll be discussing the human botfly, Dermatobia hominis. And my guests this week are Dr. Kristen Swihart and Anne Skerritt. Welcome back, both of you, to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. I'll find out if I regret it or not.
I hope you don't. I hope you find it entertaining and wonderful and lovely. And I'm wondering if we could start out by having each of you just share a little bit about yourselves. Kristen, you have a science background, so if you could share a little bit about your scientific background too, that would be great.
Okay. I have a background in microbiology and immunology. I've worked with the World Health Organization. And I'm a friend and coworker of Sam's. I love learning about diseases and how they interact with the body and the body interacts with them. So this is right up my alley. I've had a lot of fun times with Sam, and this is continuing that tradition.
Awesome. Thank you. Anne, you want to share a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I took a microbiology class in the late 80s, and all I remember is that there's a Gram stain that you do, but I don't remember what it does. So I will be interpreting, asking questions from the scientists because I went and ended up going into engineering, so I don't know really any science.
No worries. This podcast is for everyone, no matter what your background is. And I had a super fun time coming up with the recipes for today's episode. I'm going to bring them out one at a time and sequence them in the order of the stage of the life cycle that they each represent. So get ready. Here they come. So for your first course, I've got some shrimp with a topping of caviar. And the shrimp are lightly bathed in some olive oil and lemon juice. You can add a little bit more lemon juice if you like. And this represents the fact that The eggs of the human botfly are actually transported to their host by a second carrier arthropod. Not a shrimp, of course, because those are in the ocean, but I thought those would be more palatable than, say, a boiled tick. So we're going to...
Thank you.
Thank you. Shrimp's going to work.
All right, so here we are in the egg stage.
It's really yummy.
It's good.
And this is at a much different scale.
Are you going to put a picture on?
So imagine this next course is kind of a take on a caprese salad. So it's mozzarella that has been cut into segments and shaved down a little bit so that it looks like a botfly maggot. So imagine that this is the botfly maggot that has just emerged from its egg, been deposited on someone's flesh, and is getting ready to burrow inside. You'll see that it's lying on a bed of orange lentils, and it has got some little hooks on its anterior end, which is the fatter end, that it uses to get its way into the skin, and then the black sesame seeds represent the spines that are on each of the segments.
So, Sam, the eggs are deposited on the skin.
Yeah.
They hatch,
yeah.
And then the larva burrows.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And this, of course, is magnified many times. This is not actual size.
It's almost as big as my arm.
No idea.
All right. This one is a little bit more abstract. But what we have here, so you have a portobello mushroom cap stuffed with a Italian sausage, and then a coating of melted white cheddar cheese. And then you have a clove of garlic emerging from a hole in the center, surrounded by a tiny bit of barbecue sauce. So this is representing how the larva is either just starting to enter the skin or has been in the skin for a while and is coming up for a breath.
It does look appropriately marginally disgusting because the barbecue sauce looks a bit like blood, and then there's this thing coming out.
It's also really appropriate for the day after Halloween. It looks very Halloween-y.
Okay, so technically this one is not a life stage. This represents, or this is an allusion to a common cure that is mentioned in a lot of the literature, which is the bacon cure. And we'll talk more about that later. But for this course, you have some chunks of zucchini and some tomatoes, some cherry tomatoes that have been wrapped with bacon and then baked in the oven. So they should be quite tasty. And then to represent the pupal phase, you have some olives. And then just as an accompaniment, if you want a little carbohydrate to go with all of this protein and fat, you've got a couple of dinner rolls. So how does it look, friends?
Well, the bacon and the olives and the shrimp all look pretty palatable. If you don't think of the caviar as fly larva, but the larva on the with the cheese is like really well, and the mushrooms are a little bit disturbing.
The mushrooms are something out of a horror film.
Yeah, I mean, they really are capturing infection sort of at its midpoint, where you've got, you know, a larva actively in the flesh of something. And that barbecue sauce, I know, does add to the ick factor, but it does kind of represent that you do get some oozing of some fluids from the hole around the larva while it is inside the tissue.
I want to make a note to listeners that I am eating while she is talking about this.
I'm very proud of you. Thank you for persisting through this. Okay. So please go ahead and enjoy yourselves. Feel free to partake of any of those courses. Enjoy a little bit of that Pinot Noir from the Willamette Valley that we have as an accompaniment. And I will dive into talking about the biology. So before we dive into the specifics of botflies, I want to give just a little attention to the larger order of insects to which they belong, order Diptera, otherwise known as the flies. Everyone's familiar with flies, and for most people, our associations with them tend to be negative. Bottle flies and fruit flies make a nuisance of themselves by buzzing around our kitchens and landing on our food. Biting flies like mosquitoes, black flies, and horse flies cause itchy bumps and sometimes carry diseases. And their larvae, more commonly known as maggots, are generally considered repulsive. Behind these unfortunate characteristics are some actually fascinating animals. There are at least 150,000 species of flies that have been described, with many more estimated to exist, and they inhabit almost every environment on our planet, including Arctic regions, where they're the most diverse group of insects. Many fly species serve as pollinators of plants, including cacao, which is the plant that chocolate comes from. So without flies, there would be no chocolate. Their larvae also play an important role in decomposition and thus nutrient cycling in ecosystems. One of their defining characteristics is that they only have one pair of wings, whereas most other insects have two pairs of wings. Instead of a second pair of wings, they have a pair of organs called halteres that look kind of like two tiny wooden spoons that stick out from the thorax. The halteres act as gyroscopic sensors that enable flies to make extremely rapid changes in direction while flying, giving them their extraordinary ability to dodge fly swatters wielded by hapless humans. Acrobatic flying is a necessary part of botfly reproduction, so I decided that this was worth including as a detail. Now, you guys have had a little opportunity to dig in and try some of the dishes. How are they tasting?
The dishes that look less appetizing are super, super good.
Awesome. I'm so glad.
Yeah, everything tastes wonderful. There's a lot of flavor and texture, and it's yummy.
Super good.
Awesome. I'm so glad that you're enjoying it. I was a little worried as you were reacting to the initial presentation. Okay, now on to the star of the show, Dermatobia hominis in the family Ostridae, otherwise known as the human botfly, which is a misleading name because while it frequently infects humans, it can easily infect other mammals as well. It inhabits the tropical and subtropical regions of the Americas, preferring hilly, wet forests. There are about 150 other botfly species as well that are distributed globally, infecting a range of mammals, which can occasionally infect people. One species in particular, Gastrophilus intestinalis, causes quite a lot of issues with horses, where it makes its way from the skin to their digestive tract. In general, the term for infestation by maggots is called myiasis, which is kind of hard to pronounce, so I am probably only going to say it that one time. But back to the human botfly. I'll start with the adult human botflies, which have a very brief life, so brief that they don't possess mouth parts and cannot feed. They look a bit like bees with stout bodies that are covered in yellowish-orange hairs that give them a fuzzy appearance. Males court females with a pouncing display, and sometimes interrupt mating couples with pouncing attacks, possibly as a form of competition for access to receptive females. After mating, the female employs a very interesting strategy to transport her eggs to a mammalian host. She first captures another arthropod, often a mosquito, using her incredible acrobatic flying ability, and glues her eggs to the arthropod's body, then releases the arthropod without harming it.
What's the glue?
That's a really great question. I mean, it is something that she secretes specifically to act as a glue, but I don't know the chemical makeup of it. But it is a very sticky substance. It does a good job of causing those eggs to really stick on and adhere to the carrier arthropod and keeping them there while it flies around.
Wow. That is an ingenious method of getting your eggs onto somebody.
Right? I mean, it's really pretty incredible.
It's also a lot of work. Imagine having to catch a mosquito, lay your eggs on it without hurting it and releasing it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Amazing world of science.
Yeah. And it sort of makes you wonder, like, how that evolved. Like, why is that adaptive? Why not just lay your eggs right on the host? I'm wondering if it has to do with the fact that they are so short-lived that in case they don't find a host, they're likely to... There are tons and tons of arthropods around in the environment. There are fewer mammals. And so if you can catch another arthropod and deposit your eggs, then you're okay. Your eggs are probably going to make it to a mammal somewhere.
The mammal might be easier to catch, though.
Yeah, undoubtedly. Undoubtedly. I mean, imagine like trying to like capture a mosquito midair. It's crazy. So now imagine that mosquito or other arthropod is carrying a load of botfly eggs until it lands on a warm-blooded host where the increase in temperature triggers the eggs to hatch, releasing larvae onto the host's skin. The larvae then often use the hole left by the biting insect as their entry point to invade the host tissue. A botfly female typically lays 800 to 1,000 eggs in her short life, and more than 40 different arthropod species, including ticks and various biting flies, have been identified with botfly eggs attached to them.
What you guys are missing is the faces that Sam and I, not Sam, Ann and I, are making as we hear that 800 eggs could be laid.
Yeah, I mean, you gotta spread those genes, man.
So when they lay all that many eggs, it's on different mosquitoes and different bugs, not all on one.
That is the implication, yeah.
And then the heat of the mammalian body releases the glue?
It doesn't release the glue necessarily, but it causes the eggs to hatch. So it triggers a reaction so that the larvae hatch out of the eggs.
Oh, okay, so like the eggshell or whatever you do when you're a larvae, stay on the mosquito.
Potentially.
Maybe.
Okay. So I've sort of eaten around the sensitive area.
I can see that. I can see that. You haven't really gotten to the infected portion of the sausage flesh of the stuffed mushroom.
I'm working up my courage.
You could close your eyes.
I have to admit, I cut the mushroom without the infected bit.
You know, that's fair. I, you know, don't feel obligated to eat every part of it.
I'm just having fun.
Excellent. So once the larvae are in contact with the host skin, they start the process of inhabiting their host. And for the rest of the life cycle, I'm going to rely heavily on quotes from an article that was published in 1930 by Lawrence H. Dunn called Rearing the Larvae of Dermatobia hominis in Man. In this article, Dunn painstakingly describes the development of botfly larvae in his own body.
Oh my God.
Oh, it gets better. It gets better. He would not be the last person to describe this process, as believe it or not, so many people have documented their own personal botfly infections, either in journal articles or online, that it is practically its own genre of naturalist nonfiction.
Wait, is it all scientists who do this or do other?
Sometimes it's tourists. Oh. Yeah, people who come back from vacation in the tropics and yeah.
I knew somebody who worked for the French government and they were stationed with their family in Senegal for 6 years and their daughter got a botfly.
It Nasty. Happens. It happens, man. Now, I will say that Dunn's level of detail I found to be unmatched. Dr. Dunn, sir, I am in debt to your commitment and your deft use of language in describing your journey as both host and scientific observer. So he begins with the serendipitous discovery of botfly eggs. Quote, in October 1929, while seated at the edge of a small stream near Summit Canal Zone, I captured a fly which was hovering about and which had several times alighted on my right knee. This fly proved to be a species of Limnophora, not a bloodsucker, and a number of eggs were found attached to her abdomen. An examination of these showed them to be eggs of Dermatobia hominis. Many of them had developed to the larval stage, the operculum at the hatching end being open, and the minute larva inside each being active and ready to leave its shell when a suitable host was provided. End quote.
So he could see these. So they're not minuscule. They're not like microscopic.
They are not microscopic. No, I mean, I would assume that he probably used a hand lens to aid in seeing it. But they are big enough that I think you could see them with the naked eye. You probably couldn't identify them and tell exactly what species. He probably had to use a hand lens for that.
I could definitely not identify them.
I am down to the larva.
You, in fact, have the larva on your fork. Are you going to go for it?
Yep, we're just noting the moment.
She's surviving. It's going down.
How did it taste?
Like garlic.
Like garlic, yeah. Good. Awesome. So what Dr. Dunn did next is something I found to be unique among firsthand accounts of botfly parasitism. He decided to place the newly hatched larva on his skin and purposefully allow them to burrow into his flesh.
Woo.
Oh my God.
I know. This is commitment.
He gave his body to science before he died.
True. Again, I quote the intrepid Dr. Dunn. Quote, the two larvae were placed in the skin slightly less than an inch apart, and each remained at exactly the site where it was placed. Neither of them could be detected as having moved even a quarter of an inch. They remained so motionless that at first it was feared that they had been injured by the needle in transferring them from the tube to my arm. After watching them closely with a 10x lens for a few minutes, however, a few faint contractions could be seen. And it was also noted that the anterior or larger end of each larva seemed to be sinking very slowly into the skin. This large end of each larva seemed to be about one-third horizontally pressed into the skin and was evidently securing traction through the use of the oral hooks and dermal spines, while the posterior end exerted a progressive forward motion. End quote.
Squirmy. I just have to say that I think Kristen just ate the anterior fangs.
I did.
Oh, did you? You ate the anterior fangs? Yeah, there. That was
one of them.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, no, that was, I think, a marinated bell pepper. So he lets these burrow into his skin. Now, it didn't happen as fast as you might think it would happen. It took one larva 42 minutes to completely embed itself in the skin. Well, the other took an hour and 35 minutes.
I could barely sit in the chair just listening to it.
Right? And that seems like a long time. Doesn't that seem like a long time to you?
Yeah. I mean, I guess they don't wipe off really easy because you could be doing all sorts of things.
Well, yeah, because it seems like something a person might notice. But apparently, it is subtle enough that most people don't notice it at all unless they are deliberately infecting themselves. And this subtlety is supported by the fact that while Dr. Dunn was capturing flies and retrieving eggs, he was unwittingly parasitized by four additional larvae.
Poor guy.
Quote, apparently it had been just a case of carrying coals to Newcastle when I allowed the two larvae to enter my left arm, since I evidently was already infested with four of them at the time. It is quite certain that these four larvae were deposited on me by the carrier fly while it was alighting on me just prior to its capture. This placed their entrance into my skin at about 6 hours earlier than when the two entered my left arm. Finding myself now infested with six of the larvae, I decided to allow them all to remain until they begin to produce too great a reaction, either local or general. End quote. So then he numbers each of these larvae and goes on to take very, very detailed notes of their progress in a diary format.
He did not give them names.
No, he didn't get, not that I'm aware of. I mean, he did not include that in his publication. But, you know, given how intimate he became with them, you know, one might suspect that he would have. So this, I think, is a great time for just sort of an off-the-cuff question. If you were raising a botfly larvae in your own skin, what would you name it?
Smash?
Disgusting.
Maggie. So, here is Dr. Dunn's entry for October 24th. Quote, "The lesions have increased in size and have more of the appearance of small boils, which have pointed and erupted slightly. There is considerable oozing of serous fluid, blood-stained pus, and dark-colored matter, which I believe is digested blood being defecated by the larvae."
I'm glad I've already eaten my mushroom.
So wait, how much time has passed since it went in and it started oozing?
Ooh, I'd have to go back and look at the original article, but I think this is pretty early on, actually, like within the first week. I'm going to continue the quote. "The exudate from the lesions is now sufficient to be quite disagreeable, owing to its staining clothing and bedding, and it is necessary to bandage all the lesions. It is to be regretted that the bandages were not applied earlier, so that the date of possibly a first molt of the larvae might have been noted," end quote. And I can really sense here, I think you probably can too, that he is genuinely disappointed at missing this opportunity for another data point on the life cycle. Fortunately, however, he does indeed find evidence of molting and even observes one larva ejecting a cast skin from its hole. Right? So I will describe that to you because, you know, it like everything, it has some really great detail. Quote, "At about 7 o'clock this evening, when the bandages were removed for a while, this larva was found to be pushing out a cast skin. The larva had molted, and since it probably needed more room in the hole for its future growth, was disposing of the cast skin. The movements of the larva caused the skin to emerge in its natural round tube-like form. As it came slowly out, it formed a tiny crater about 2 millimeters high around the hole, and then continued to turn back upon itself, with the posterior end of the larvae pushing up through the center. From the manner in which the molted skin moved slightly from side to side, it appeared as though the larva was pushing it up first at one side and then at the other, but keeping it about even so that the rows of hooks on each segment were all out before those of the next segment appeared. After observing the efforts of the larva with a hand lens for about 3 hours, it was estimated that about 1/3 of the cast skin was still in the hole," end quote.
Wow, that's a long time. That's a patient little larvae.
3 hours. The man watched this for 3 hours.
Patient scientist.
Mm. Patient scientist. And or, you know, entertainment was lacking in the canal zone in Panama in 1929. So throughout these observations, Dr. Dunn describes multiple bouts of extreme discomfort, ranging from prickling and itching to excruciating pain, accompanied by fever and fatigue. So I'm going to take a minute here to describe the botfly maggot itself, which I find somehow both horrifying and slightly adorable at the same time. They look like relatively chunky maggots with rows of spikes protruding along each segment that help them to maneuver within the host skin and avoid being ejected. They also have some hardened mouth parts that look kind of like two vampire fangs, and they have two spiracles that stick out of their posterior end that they often push to the surface to help them breathe. The anterior end with the mouth parts is usually pointed downwards into the flesh where the larvae feeds on fluids and tissue. They can be surprisingly large. Dr. Dunn's larvae ranged from 20 to 25 millimeters in length and 7 to 11 millimeters in diameter by the time they emerged. Yeah, so they're not small. And you can imagine that something that size with spikes all over its body would definitely cause some discomfort, depending on where it was. So I've personally known a few tropical biologists who had botflies but found them to be too painful to allow them to grow to maturity, opting instead for extraction. Now, if extraction is the route one decides to pursue, most people agree that rather than going to a doctor in the United States, a local person with specific expertise in botfly removal is the best option. Methods vary, but they generally involve covering the hole with something that limits airflow to cause the maggot to start pushing itself out to avoid suffocation. Bacon is mentioned more than once as the tool of choice for smothering the botfly. In fact, there is at least one published medical journal article confirming the effectiveness of using bacon, which was applied to the patient's skin for 3 hours before the larva emerged far enough for extraction to take place. Once the maggot is partially emerged, people often squeeze it out the rest of the way, being careful to avoid any parts of the maggot breaking off inside the hole and getting stuck, which can cause infection. Now, interestingly, infection of botfly cavities in the skin is pretty rare as long as the larvae is alive and no parts of it come off. And this is thought to be due to secretion of antimicrobial compounds from the larva itself. Now, I struggled to find any specific research identifying the compounds that are secreted by the actual human botfly, but there's strong evidence for antimicrobial compounds in the maggots of other fly species, particularly the maggots of the green bottlefly, which are used in maggot therapy for wound debridement. Kristen, you've probably heard of this.
Yes.
But have not experienced it.
No. My debridement was more surgical than botfly based.
Yeah. I mean, if I ever needed a wound debrided, I might request the maggots just because I like find it really fascinating. But I suppose that, I don't know, that might not be covered by insurance.
If it's cheap, maybe it is.
Yeah. I mean, who knows? Overall, botfly typically causes no serious problems for a human host other than discomfort. There have unfortunately been rare cases of fatality. These involve the maggots reaching the brain in human infants because their skulls haven't fused completely, and so there is an entry point into the brain directly from the skin.
Would they have to land on the head, or did they actually?
Oh, okay. So imagine like it gets into it, the scalp.
Yeah.
And then manages to go through the area where the skull's not fused and get into the brain. That is extremely rare. It's tragic, but very rare. Now, in the case of Dr. Dunn, the first two of his larvae emerged after 46 days, and the last larvae emerged after 54 days. So 54 days is how long he had it inside his body.
Did it hurt the whole time, you know? Did he feel it the whole time?
Well, you know, he does give diary entries almost daily. And at the beginning, it starts with like prickling feelings and maybe transient episodes of sharp pains that last 1 to 3 minutes. But towards the end, it starts to be like some pretty intense pain. Plus, he starts to have some fever and fatigue and he's not sleeping well. So,
guy's a nut.
Or very dedicated. So he describes each exit in great detail. Here's just one example. Quote, "There has been very little movement felt at numbers 1 and 5 today. This evening, the bandages were left off for a time, and the larvae were observed with a lens. Both these larvae could be seen working vigorously, enlarging the apertures to their lesions. This was done entirely by the spines on the posterior segments. They were rubbed against the side of the hole with a rasping motion.
There's spines down there.
And this was carried on at first one side of the hole and then the other." Are you going to rasp with your spines?
Looking at the spines.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Her larva has spines on the end.
Yes. Now I've lost myself. Okay. "This was done entirely by the spines on the posterior segments. They were rubbed against the side of the hole with a rasping motion, and this was carried on at first one side of the hole and then the other. It reminded one of enlarging a round hole with a round file. At intervals of from 5 to 10 minutes each, of the larvae protruded from its hole for more than a quarter of an inch, as though testing the diameter of the opening to see if it be large enough to permit the emergence of the larger anterior end. After protruding for a few minutes, the larva withdrew within the lesion and again began its rasping on the edge of the opening. This continued for about 3 hours.
Oh, wow.
When the bandages were again applied. There was considerable movement in number 5 today, and the escape of pus and digested blood from this lesion was sufficient to soak through the dressing twice during the day. End quote.
It was summer 1929 on the Panama Canal. I was catching insects all alone and desperate for a pal. Along came 6 young maggots from eggs glued to a fly. I invited them to eat my flesh, and gladly they complied. They burrowed in and made a home beneath my tender skin, and feasted there for 7 weeks on the liquid stuff within. When last they rose and left their holes to pupate in a bin, I was alone in Panama, no more botflies as my friends.
So are like the pus and stuff, is that like excrement from when it eats whatever it's eating inside the body and then it digests it and it pusses it out?
There is probably a combination of things going on. So it's probably just some fluid that is coming from the tissues that is sort of leaking out. There's probably some blood. There's probably also, it is probably some excrement from the maggot that's just, you know, the digested blood and tissue.
And it's probably immune system cells getting in there trying to get rid of the guy.
Probably so. I mean, I know that there is some immune suppression going on by the maggot, but one would imagine there would be some immune response happening for sure. So after the larvae emerged, Dr. Dunn placed them in damp sand and sawdust to pupate. And he recorded the emergence of the adult flies after 22 to 24 days. Less well-cared-for botfly maggots typically just fall off the host and pupate in the soil or leaf litter, emerging as adults for a brief few days to mate and glue their eggs to another carrier insect to transport to a warm-blooded host. And thus the life cycle is complete. If you yourself travel to a forested region of the Neotropics, you may also be as lucky or unlucky, depending on how you look at it, to be parasitized by a botfly. If you want to avoid this, the best course of action is to avoid your skin being visited by insects or ticks. An insect repellent containing DEET can be helpful, as can clothing treated with permethrin. It also helps to sleep in an area enclosed by window screens or mosquito netting. So, any closing thoughts on the human botfly or your meal?
The timing is fascinating with me. So it's like almost 60 days inside of you as a larva, like 22 days at a pupate, and then was it 72 hours as an adult?
Yeah, a few days. Yeah.
That is really short, especially compared to the other.
Yeah, and that's not uncommon in insects. There are a number of insect species in which that happens. So notably mayflies. You know, if you've ever seen mayflies emerging from a river, it tends to happen all at one time. You have this sort of big swarm of mayflies. They live a very short period of time, but they live as larvae in the stream for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. And of course, the most notable insect that one could cite in terms of variation in life cycle stages would be the cicadas. I mean, some of those guys are in the soil as larvae and pupae for 17 years before they come out as adults and are only alive for a few days.
So, if a botfly got its eggs on a human via a mosquito, and that botfly came out in a house, that's sort of a dead end.
One would think so. Yeah. It depends. You know, it depends on if it landed somewhere. If it landed somewhere where you didn't vacuum frequently, it might be just fine.
An old dirty rug.
But of course, then it would have to find a carrier insect when it emerged as an adult.
So tell me about the species specificity of different species of botflies.
Well, that's a great question. So what I found, I mean, so there's about 150 different species of botflies. They appear to be relatively nonspecific. So a lot of them can infect a variety of mammals, but they seem to have some preference, some host preference. I don't know how that works, given that they're not actually transporting their eggs themselves. I don't know if it's that they have a preference for carrier insects that also have a specific host preference. But that would be a really great question. But fascinating the way that they use these carrier insects to get their larvae to a host.
Really amazing. I mean, it's like that smart body sense, right? Because they don't have a really big brain. It's just kind of genetically what they can do, or?
Yeah, I mean, it appears to be a hardwired behavior, right? It's not something that they have to learn. I mean, if they had to learn it, they would have a really short time.
And there's no mom around to train them.
Exactly. You just got to come out of that. Out of that pupil stage, ready to go. Other thoughts? Other questions?
The food was really good. I liked the lentils that represented the skin. And actually, I could actually eat it while we're talking about the botfly. So I think I've got progress.
Excellent.
Good job, Anne. I'm super proud of you. And I enjoyed sharing faces with you and gestures.
Yeah, well done, guys. You persevered through some pretty gross food references throughout the course of this. So I used a number of sources to inform this episode, and I want to highlight a few that were extremely helpful. Of course, I drew heavily from the article Rearing the Larvae of Dermatobia hominis in Man, written by Lawrence H. Dunn and published in 1930 in the journal Psyche. Another resource I found particularly useful for its descriptions was an online article on botflies from the Missouri Department of Conservation. Nice job, Missouri. I also used pages from the CDC and NIH on myiasis, along with Wikipedia articles on botflies, Dermatobia hominis, and the order Diptera. And of course, you can see a full list of works cited on my website. I'd like to offer my thanks again to my wonderful guests, Dr. Kristen Swihart and Anne Skerritt. Thank you again for joining me on this episode.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah,
the food was great. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. It was highly entertaining, especially Kristen. I wish we could have filmed it. Her faces are fabulous.
Yeah, eventually we'll be on YouTube. And thank you, listeners, for joining me and my friends on Worst Guest Ever. Please check out our website at worstguesteverpodcast.com. That's worstguesteverpodcast, all one word, .com. You can find links to not only the sources I used in my research, but also transcripts and recipes featured on the show. If you enjoyed the show, please rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. Our theme song is an artistic collaboration with piano music composed and performed by Jan May, vocals by the multi-talented Dr. Julia Willis, and lyrics by yours truly. Additional music for the intro was a piece called Stumbling Tango by Ludwig Mulland.